Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Bristol Festival of Ideas. My name is George Miller, and at this May's festival, I was fortunate enough to get the chance to interview several of the guest speakers. On the 22nd of May, poet, writer and broadcaster Jackie Kay visited the city, and I'm very pleased to say that she is my guest in this podcast. Jackie is the author of a remarkable memoir called Red Dust Road, in which she reflects on her relationship with her adoptive parents, and her experience of tracing her biological mother to Milton Keynes, and her father to Nigeria. Experiences which open up new perspectives on her identity, without delivering the happy ending of sentimental films and novels. "See your life," her mum says to her at one point, "you couldn't make it up." And the reader would be hard-pressed to disagree. I began the interview by asking at what point she had decided she was going to turn that extraordinary life into a book.
I think that I started to think that it might actually become a book when I went to Nigeria for the first time in 2002 and met my birth father, and that experience was so extraordinary and astonishing, surprising and bizarre, as it felt as if I was in some kind of a fiction. It felt as if my actual life had become fiction, and that there was no point in making a story up about it, no point in fictionalizing my life, because my life already felt like an odd mixture of facts and fiction, and my adoptive parents felt like the facts, and my biological parents felt like the fiction, and that was the opposite way around how most people conceive the business of nature, and nurture. They always talk about your real parents, meaning your biological parents, but to me, my real parents were my adoptive parents, and my birth parents were kind of half imagination and half real, and meeting them didn't stop them being less imaginary and strangely.
And you open the book with that extraordinary scene, don't you, where you meet your birth father for the first time, and I was wondering, you know, was a writer in you, I mean, the sort of human being is often taking it in on all sorts of levels, but was a writer in you also kind of, sort of, in a way, recording it and thinking, oh my God, this is astonishing?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. It's true that, you know, if there's a writer in you, there's always a writer in you, wherever you are. It's why the writers are often described as cannibals and cold-hearted and all sorts. But I would say that the writer in you, rather than being cold-hearted, you're thinking, aha, I can turn this experience into a book. The writer in you saves you in experiences like that because it allows you of another eye, perhaps a more objective eye, of seeing the situation. And so instead of just being hurt or traumatized by being trapped in a room with your father dancing around you and trying to cleanse you and performing an elaborate cleansing ritual, the writer in you is recreating it in an easier way for your own eye. So the writer in you allows you to survive situations better.
Of that scene where he performs a sort of 2 hours of Simon and ritual are funny and bizarre, but also the reader's very aware of the sort of real human vulnerability of what you're sort of exposing yourself to. And there's a moment at which you ask him if he ever thought about you during all those years, and he says, "Well, no, I didn't. Why would I?" So I mean, there's real potential for exposing yourself to hurt, isn't there, in going to a situation like that?
Yeah, I think there's a gauge when you're any adopted person that takes on the business and the journey, the odyssey really, of tracing, that exposes themselves to potential hurt. It can be self-destructive, right? And it can just pile an extra rejection on top of one that might already be simmering there under the surface for years, and you do take enormous risks. And part of that journey was very hurtful, there's no getting away from it. It was very hurtful and very upsetting. But I still actually wouldn't think in hindsight that I wish I hadn't done it and that I wish I hadn't exposed myself to that hurt. I'm kind of glad that I took it on the chin and survived it and also got something out of it, perhaps that other people can find useful as well as myself.
And of course, by the time that you went to look for your father, you'd already gone through the process of tracing your mother and encountering her, so you already had that experience, which had also sort of its sort of challenges, hadn't it? It hadn't been straightforward, that sort of meeting. You know, you sort of imagine how it might be and how it sometimes is in films, but each person's experience is different.
Yes, and meeting my mother was also, I found, really traumatic and upsetting in lots of ways, and actually it stopped me from searching for my father for years, because I actually thought I didn't really necessarily want to go through that again. So there was, you know, 20 years between finding one and finding another. It took 20 years to recover. But in many ways, ways my birth mother and birth father are very similar and living perfect match to each other. Both are unusual religions, she being a Mormon and he being a born-again Christian. Both are highly secretive. Both didn't tell their present families anything about me. Both have kept me secret for all of their lives. And both link God to their own behaviour. So they both have said, God has advised me on this and God has agreed with me that it's best to keep me secret. And she said a similar thing. So that was kind of fascinating to me to find two parents so similar and yet been apart for years.
Fascinating, but also must have been tough, because I suppose, on a lot of averages, you might think, well, one birth parent might be able to talk and introduce you to their other children and their wider family, but to have two parents who are secretive must have been tough.
Yes, it was tough, and especially since it was different to the experience of lots of my friends that had done the same thing, and lots of people that you read about and you see on the television. You're always seeing people that chase long lost family as the series at the moment, and as good as you think you are with another series, you're always seeing people chase original families, and then there's these big scenes of happy reunions and everybody crying and hugging each other. And actually, the truth, I suspect, for a lot of people, not just myself, is that it's rather more flattening than that, that it's something and nothing. That you meet somebody and you feel a sense of recognition, a kind of DNA hum, but you also feel a dislocation because you're strangers, you're relative strangers, your relatives and your strangers. And so there is something fundamentally disappointing built into it. And then if you've got people that are not necessarily that happy that you've got in touch with them and they're not necessarily that happy to have found you or interested in you even, then that is a blow. But I was lucky in the sense that I do feel very secure in myself. I think if it happened to somebody who was less secure in themselves, it really could knock them off the edge. And for me, it did upset me and it did make me sort of have lots of sleepless nights, but it didn't knock me off the edge.
And because they both are quite reserved and in the access they're going to give to their current lives, but also to their own past, you, in a sense, take on part of the job of trying to kind of reimagine that past or bring that past to life when you go to Aberdeen. And I thought you were wonderfully honest about it. Just how difficult it is to actually bring that to life, to make them more than just sort of insubstantial ghosts. Where, I suppose some less honest writers might have gone there and sort of indulged in sort of a recreative effort. You're honest about saying it's actually hard to bring them back to life. I mean, in the past.
Well, I think that's a really good question, and I think it really, when you have got birth parents that you've never met and then you meet them like late in life, they exist in a kind of hallucinatory way, part ghosts, they haunt you, and they haunt your lives, and you have fantasy versions of them. Well, in my life, I have fantasy versions. My adoptive mum would indulge me in this, and she'd say, I'm pictured in a Paul Robeson type jockey, maybe mixed in with a bit of Nelson Mandela. Or another time we would be like a Sydney body figure. Anyway, we both liked dating the story of this African man, and it was quite romantic. And I realised it's a story, and the story in your own head is actually very potent, and the imaginary version is often more satisfying than the real one. But the idea of trying to actually make them real, even when they become real, and even when you find them, is still a problem. And that sounds like a paradox. A philosophical paradox, but it's not really. I think it's just the truth. I think the truth of the matter is that you can't really have two lives. You can only have one, and that you are dependent on much stronger connections than DNA and blood and genealogy to make a real connection with somebody. You need memory, experience, shared incidents.
Well, I thought one of the most wonderful chapters in the book was the one called Mull, which is really a sort of contrast to that sort of flickering, insubstantial life that you have to imagine for your biological parents. And it's a chapter in which you are sort of weaving together all the memories of the childhood holidays that you had with your adoptive parents. It's so sort of warm and intense. And I mean, tell me from a writing point of view how you sort of set about creating that, because you're not writing it in your own first person voice, are you? What are you doing with
that? I really did want that chapter to contrast with the other one too, so that you're the first person that said that, so that's interesting. Sometimes you do things that people don't necessarily notice. them. I really wanted there to be a sense that the real life, or my real life, is with my adopted parents, and that is very grounded, it's very earthy, there are specifics, it's not got that elusive, ethereal, wraith-like presence. It's not present by its absence, it's present by its presence. And so that chapter, I just kind of did a riff, really. It was like having a jazz riff to myself. I just started off with Mull, because it's the first holiday that I remember when I was four, when my brother and I went there when I was four, and it's so vivid to me. It's partly also because my mum and dad talk about holidays all the time. It's their favourite thing. They still do that, and they're in their 80s. We sit around the table, and they talk. Go back over and over and over the holiday memories, partly because it was a time when we were all together, because my dad worked really hard and was out of that, but partly just because I think they loved, absolutely loved their holidays. So it means that I'm lucky that I've got two parents that are still alive, both with very good memories, and both with a great storytelling power. So I really wanted that chapter to give you all three of the voices and not change any punctuation in it. I didn't kind of try and help the reader out with which voice was which. I just hoped the reader would have got a sense by then of whether it was my dad speaking or whether it was my mum or whether it was me. But actually, it didn't matter because it was a kind of a fusion. I think of it as more like a kind of jazz piece and sort of spontaneously riffing on the idea of one holiday and one holiday reminds you of this. And also the way that memory exists, that even if things were years apart, when we remember things, they're very close together. So one event will trigger another. One dog and one holiday will trigger another dog and another holiday.
And it's not just about dwelling in the past, because people say dwelling in the past, and that's pejorative, isn't it? Because it's kind of part of what constitutes them as people, and it's part of what constitutes them as a couple, it's part of what constitutes you as a family unit, and it kind of takes you into the future too. So that's a really positive way to think about memories, not just about, you know, something that's gone in the rear of your mirror, but actually something that's binding you together and gives you a future tense too.
Yes, because I think we're made up, our possible futures are largely dependent on how much we can carry our past intact with us. You can see that particularly with people who get Alzheimer's or dementia, how fractured that can be, or people who have sudden illnesses that separate them from their memory. I think that if you're able to all remember together, and some of those memories are happy memories, and even if you debate them or disagree with them or remember different things, you still have a way of forming a kind of a group self, which is the best of families, is that you have a shared memory and you have a shared identity. And there's something really, really lucky, and I feel very blessed and lucky to have that, because I know so many people that are not really close to their parents or haven't maybe had that in their lives and don't do anything like that kind of reminiscing in order to go forward, in a sense, reminiscing in order to have a future. It's like there's more future in the past than there is in the future, or there can only be a future if there is a future in the past, if you see what I mean.
And in sort of my reading of the book, I sort of juxtaposed in my head that chapter on Mull, but the three of you are sort of so inextricably linked, so it's difficult to tell which voice is speaking. With a very short chapter later in the book, where you're imagining your biological parents, you're imagining your father striding out to some meeting, and his head is full of his botany, because he's a tree specialist, and you imagine your mother, your biological mother, who's sitting waiting to go to church, and she's been up and dressed and sits atop, and there's something very separate and poignant and rather sad about the sort of separateness. They're both in their way sort of bound up in their own world and their own thoughts, and that to me contrasted very sharply with the sort of cohesiveness of the family unit you describe.
Yeah, I suppose I think of them, I mean, perhaps because I have to, and perhaps because I haven't seen them properly with their families in any acknowledged way, but I think of them as being very alone, both my birth father and birth father, which is probably not real. It's probably a lot of that is actually in my head, but I do think of them as being people that are alone in a very essential way with their God. And in that chapter, which occurs very late on in the book, I wanted to find a way of bringing them together So they don't even share a paragraph. I didn't break the paragraph between one and the other. I kept them in the same paragraph because I wanted to find that little chapter. Actually took me ages at one point. I'd written that chapter as having an imaginary meeting between both sets of parents. I wrote all these different imaginary meetings between them, and that I just didn't, they weren't truthful enough, they didn't work. So I had to ditch them, and that was what came in its place.
I really like the fact you didn't write the paragraph, because I did ponder it. I thought you must have decided it must be absolutely constant deliberate, because a natural, and natural thing, not right, well, but one, you know, in typing that kind of scene, would instinctively hit the space bar, and having imagined your father, then imagined your mother, I thought, no, either you've decided consciously at the start, or you've actually gone back and you've stitched them together. And in a way, in a sort of paradoxical way, the fact that it was one paragraph made it seem more poignant and more separate somehow. Mm-hmm. Because there they were, and the reader had to sort of think, you know, we've moved several thousand miles, and when something completely different, and yet they're together and not together.
I conceived of it as one paragraph, one big paragraph, and then a tiny little three or four lines at the end, just of on her own, and I conceived of it like that because I wanted to at least bring them together there, because in a sense, because it's the act of me trying to find a way to bring them together, at least in my imagination, which is what every child wants in a very childish way. Every person in the world likes to imagine their parents to have been in love and to have been made out of love, not out of boredom or hate or anything else. And so whether we're adopted or not, people often do that. They often return to early meetings in their own heads of their parents' meeting and romanticise it to a certain extent. People like to do that because they like to think that they've come out of that, and anything else is a huge disappointment. I think the desire to do that is interesting in itself, with that desire to make stories of ourselves, whether we're adopted or not, to try and bring something together. And particularly people whose parents might divorce or separate or get lost to each other. There's this, you know, we're partly defined in our life, I think, by what we've lost. And when we have lost something quite large, we try and find a way of finding it and putting it back together again. Kind of Humpty Dumpty style.
You're a huge advocate to talk about identity at the Bristol Festival Ideas, and I wondered how problematic Scottish identity was for you when you were growing up. Because in a way, as a child, you adopt it and you accept it, but you've sort of been challenged from outside to think, well, it's not as straightforward for me as it is for other children in the class or other people you meet in the street.
I think when I was very little, it wasn't really a problem to me. I just thought of myself completely as Scottish. But then sometimes I look in the mirror and get quite a shock because everything that I saw, everybody that I saw around me didn't look like me, apart from my brother. So I would get quite a shock, really, really surprised at myself. And then when I was about to be a bit bigger and got sort of various racial abuse, that became quite complicated, thinking of myself as being Scottish and like the others. I didn't feel like the others any longer. Really, from when I went to school, actually, from when I was five and I went to school, that all started to change, the sense of just being more or less yourself. So I think the business of being Scottish is complicated if you're black, just because Scotland doesn't have the same kind of relationship to having a black population as other cities, even in England, as the one that we're in now, Bristol or Liverpool or Manchester or Birmingham or most particularly London, which is probably the most East racially mixed city in the UK. Bristol's probably got a lot of unease still because it's quite a segregated black population here, but it's nonetheless still very much a strong black presence. So I think Scotland has problems in thinking of people being black and Scottish together. They still see you very much even today as a contradiction in terms, or something funny that you should have a Scottish accent, or you might not even hear your accent and think you're from America and ask you where are you from, dear, all the time. And so if somebody asking you where are you from, dear, all the time, even in your own country, is bound to make you feel a bit ambivalent towards your country and also towards your own relationship to being Scottish. So it's complicated, it remains complicated and interesting, and I don't wish things were completely different. I wish people were more open in Scotland, and I wish there was that kind of that parochial attitude and the kind of latent racism that's there were to change, and I think it is changing, and it has changed since I was a kid. I think it needs to change. It's got a long, long way to go, and that meanwhile, myself and lots of other black friends that I have in Scotland get asked the same questions. We often get asked it for each other. People often mistake me for Suzanne Bonner. You know, I've got a friend that does that works the Inland Revenue, and people often mistake her for me. It's as if they can't cope Scotland with having more than one black person. So that's an interesting identity conundrum.
And what has exploring your Nigerian part of your identity done to your own sense of self? Because again, there are complications there. When you're in Nigeria, you're taken to be a foreigner, you're taken to be white. So again, it's not uncomplicated. But what sort of additional dimension has it created in your own sort of sense of self?
I think it's given me another room, another room to live in, which is nice. So a room that I didn't know was there when I opened the door, and the room's flooded with light. Opened these old wooden shutters, and things come as different light outside of different trees, and a different road outside the window, and different things, different fruits to see in the trees, and that's all in myself, if you like. But your identity is partly what you make of yourself inside your head, and partly how other people receive you, and how other people receive you. You know, when I went to the east of Nigeria, to my father's ancestral village, people thought of me as white, and that was really, as you say, really, really shocking and disturbing, because, my life had felt like a fish out of water in Scotland, and then I went to Nigeria and felt like that too. And I did suddenly understand the meaning of being a mixed race, and I suppose I'm kind of embracing that in a more positive way than I've done all my life from having been to Nigeria, and embracing the complexity of things in a kind of Whitmanesque way. And your marriage can contain multitudes, but also I think that lots of people feel a kind of dissonance with their original cultures. Even people that are dark black skinned that are brought up here and then go back to Nigeria might be thought of as white or culturally different. And I think a lot of it's got to do with where you're culturally brought up. How you look, people will be able to tell, even just from looking at you, that you're not from there. Not necessarily just to do with your clothes or what you're wearing, because even people that go back to Nigeria and then dress in traditional dress can get picked out right away when Nigeria is not somewhere. So there's something quite strong about people's mannerisms and ways signalling, like animals can tell when you've got a stranger. And in some sense, I would probably feel an interloper or a slightly outside both societies in that sense. I won't feel slightly outside myself, which I suppose is the main thing. I can always feel properly inside myself.
Final question, Jackie. Lots of people who've enjoyed Red Dust Road, I'm sure, will be wanting to know if there will be a sequel, because obviously the stories are ongoing. Do you imagine you will write about what happens next?
I would have said no to that, and probably the answer is no, but it's always a mistake to make categoric answers, because then people say, well, you said no a few years ago. So I would say that it's open. I mean, extraordinary events have happened to me very recently, in that I've met one of my sisters, my mother's, they read Red Dust Road and discovered that it was their mother that I was writing about, and were completely astonished because they didn't know anything about me. And so I've met one and I've yet to meet another, and that's very exciting, and other things have happened as well since I finished the book. My brother in Nigeria went and confronted our father about us, and so that was quite funny too. So lots of things have happened in my life. This feels still very much as if these extra chapters that have not been written. I might leave these chapters unwritten. I might never write them, but they have happened. If you know what I mean. And it's interesting to think that. A man came up to me at a reading the other day and said to me, this is going to be a sequel because I would like a wee bulletin every Christmas. I want to know what's going on and what's happened, and I'm really touched by that. And I've been very, very touched by the amount of letters that I've had from people all over the world, people writing saying that, some people that have gone off to find their fathers in Nigeria, and people that have decided to do things from reading the book that have been inspired to go on a kind of a journey of their own. And I've been really touched by the amount of people who have told me their stories. And in a sense, that's what I wanted from Red Dust Road more than anything else. I wanted the reader to tell themselves their own story as they were reading mine, and for the book to somehow leave enough space in it for that. And really, if it's done that, then it's done its job, and I don't know that there needs to be a sequel.
I was talking to Jackie Kay. That's all for this podcast, but there's plenty more to explore on the festival website at ideasfestival.co.uk, including an audio archive of interviews and, of course, news of forthcoming festival events. Do join me again soon for another Festival Ideas podcast, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.